You're listening to Engage with Andy Bush. To connect with the program today, please send an email to andrew.bush@comcast.net. That's andrew.bush@comcast.net. Now, back to this week's program.
Welcome back to Engage. I'm your host, Andy Bush, from andrewbush.com. In this segment, we'll be talking energy policy with James Lussier from Capital Alpha Partners in Washington, D.C. Their website is capalphadc.com. Mr. Lussier, welcome back to Engage.
It's great to be here, Andy.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Bush.
Yeah. Fantastic. You know, ladies and gentlemen, it's always a treat for me to talk to James Lussier because not only is he so knowledgeable on policy, but he also knows where the great Nouveau Beaujolais is in Washington, D.C., which is an important skill.
Absolutely.
All right, well, let's start off talking about the Keystone Pipeline. This is the one key highlighted area that everybody seems to know about and can't figure out. This passed out of the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, the bill did, on a clean basis with 58 co-sponsors. Why hasn't this passed the Senate yet?
Well, in a way, we're seeing the Senate act the way it should, which is to debate bills once in a while. And so the Senate is considering the Keystone bill with an open calendar for anyone to offer amendments. And just on one day last week, the Senate considered more amendments on the Keystone bill that it considered the entire calendar year last year.
That's amazing.
So, I mean, there's a real pent-up desire for senators to offer bills, get votes, and really engage in what the financial markets call price discovery.
Hmm.
It may seem like we're going through an unseemly spectacle with people offering amendments and everything from the wind production tax credit to LNG to crude oil exports to climate and carbon to you name it.
Right.
But the point is that it's only by asking do you get an answer. And so just as price discovery in the marketplace helps the market figure out where the valuation should be, having lots of votes on different topics in the Senate helps you sort out where the political fault lines are and where you can assemble a coalition of senators to get something done. If you never vote on anything, you really have no idea where anybody stands at the end of the day.
Wow, that, you know, I hadn't thought about that. And when, you know, you look at Congress and you feel like it's broken because nothing has gotten done very much over the last 4 years, is Harry Reid has squashed so much of the bills that were coming through. But I think that's a fascinating point you make. Now you can get a glimpse into what the senators are actually interested in doing, and therefore you can form exactly what you said, coalitions, and maybe apply that to getting them to come on board.
Exactly. Obviously, the House of Representatives has been productive as ever. The House has run on a majoritarian basis, and the House is going to crank through legislation pretty much no matter what, pretty much no matter who's running it.
Mm-hmm.
The Senate has always been very different because the Senate has 100 members, each of whom is theoretically an equal of all the others, even though there is seniority, there is a majority leader. And they're allowed to bring up any discussion they want, which is why the Senate used to be called the world's greatest deliberative body. But there's been such a fear of gotcha amendments or hard votes for Democrats in particular running in swing states or in Republican-leaning states that over the past couple of years, Harry Reid has really denied anyone the opportunity to offer amendments, even Democrats offering amendments on their own bill because he was trying to maintain such a tightly scripted process, and also, incidentally, to maintain tight control over Senate committees.
Mm.
You know, it used to be that the committee was in charge of quality control, and the committee was in charge of assembling a coalition across party lines to get something done. But Reid centralized that and made it much more difficult. So the reality is that here, this messy process of having a free and open debate on the Keystone Bill is giving everybody an opportunity to stand up and discuss their favorite widget or pet rock or whatever they want to do. And I think having more and more votes on these controversial subjects is a way of defusing them, too. so senators aren't deadly afraid of voting for something that may have not quite the right connotation they want.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point. God, this is fascinating. I get so excited about this. This is so cool, Jim, because now I understand what's happening. I had a fascinating discussion with a lobbyist on a plane talking about how to fix what was broken in Washington, D.C., about getting legislation to move forward. This lobbyist believed that going back to earmarks might be a way for, in the House, to corral members because then you have something that they want. In this case, in the Senate, what you're saying is that by shining a light on the interests of these different senators and what different proposals are out there, not only can you see what the senators are interested in, but you can also allow those senators to see if there's any other senator that's interested in what they are supporting. If not, you know, if there's no support for wind credits, for instance, if that comes up and there's only 20 people who support it, well, then they know that this is a dead horse. You don't want to keep trying to bring it up or railing against it because that doesn't, you know, hold water. So I think this is really cool, Jim.
Well, it's all about top-down organization versus bottom-up organization. And Andy,
right.
You know, markets are bottom-up so that entrepreneurs or organizers can come together and offer ideas and see who else is interested. The problem we've had in Congress really since the Gingrich era, when first the Republicans, then the Democrats had control of Congress with a very, very slim majority, Gingrich or the Senate Majority Leader would try to centralize everything.
Mm-hmm.
Also, committee chairman would try to maintain complete and total control over everything,
right,
through control of information. So, ironically, the very, very narrow working majorities have meant that the leadership really tightens the screws on everything from information flow to individual members' abilities to offer amendments to bills. And I think you got to loosen that up and you got to see what the process produces. You can't really dictate everything in advance.
Yeah.
You can't dictate the price of an IPO.
No, I think that's what a great analogy. And if you allow this to flow through for the next 2 years, which I hope McConnell does in the Senate, I think it'll be important for whoever controls the Senate in the next election, because that will be important as well to keep this regular order to allow the senators to continue to offer amendments.
Sure, and to allow the committees to function too.
Right, right. All right, well, then let me this is really interesting. All right, well, let's get back to the bill. What do you see the outcome for this thing? I mean, is it going to pass? I mean, are they going to get to 60 votes on this thing, on the Keystone?
Yeah, I think that they will get to 60 votes at the end. I had been skeptical that they would, in part because I thought that the extended amendment process would create many opportunities for Democratic members to peel off.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if members were worried about putting the president in a tough spot, forcing him to veto a bill that he didn't really want to veto, they'd be much less likely to support the bill. But the reality is that when the president comes out, even before the debate starts, and says, I'm going to veto this, in effect he's saying he doesn't care, and in effect he's giving members a free chance to to vote against him.
Yeah.
A free chance that might have helped Mary Landrieu, for instance. you know, one of the consequences of not having a lot of votes is that Mary Landrieu and other red state senators who lost, you know, Kay Hagan, for instance, had something like a 99% voting record aligned with Obama, not because she supports Obama 99% necessarily, but those were the only opportunities she had to vote.
Yeah.
And it really sank her.
Yeah.
And so
interesting.
I think Obama is kind of clearing the field and giving people a chance to vote yes to maintain voting records that are more saleable in their districts.
Right, and that certainly will help him in 2016 and really help him on trying to recapture some of the Republican seats since so many more are up in that election. I think 24 versus 10 for the Democrats.
Uh-huh.
You know, President Obama's threatened to veto the bill. You brought that up. What, you know, I mean, I know he used the Supreme Court of Nebraska as an excuse before, but I guess we're kind of past that. I guess the question is, and not to beat this too much to death, but what conditions does he want to extract to get him to sign this thing? And I think that is really the end game on it. What does the president want to sign this thing?
You know, that's getting harder and harder to tell. At one point, it looked like the president might want to extract concessions from Canada, get Canada to enact climate policy, which has been in the works over there for many years now. Many people thought that Canada would conveniently announce its policy in time for the president to sign the bill with some level of political cover. Or there was a school of thought that the president would sign the bill after announcing his program to regulate carbon emissions from power plants, but that didn't happen. I think that if you look at the president's body language these days, if you look at his dismissive reference to the pipeline in the State of the Union,
right,
saying that it was more important to build roads and bridges than, you know, a single pipeline, I think the president may actually be prepared to deny the permit. That goes against conventional wisdom. I've certainly been telling people for many years myself that I expected the president to approve it in the end with conditions. But many of the things he'd ask for in terms of conditions are already done or likely to be done, such as the new Council on Environmental Quality guidelines on carbon accounting for infrastructure projects and other environmental impact statements. These guidelines will make it very, very difficult to build anything like a Keystone pipeline in the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess taking a step back from this, I mean, this process with the president threatening, really, not only for Keystone, but I think there was about 7 veto threats in the State of the Union address, it somewhat casts a dark shadow over getting other things done, like getting a TPA and free trade agreements done and tax reform. Jim, I mean, does it really darken the skies for those things?
Well, I think so. If you looked at the president's political strategy of trying to, quote-unquote, win the lame duck by normalizing relations with Cuba, by trying to do a nuclear deal with Iran, by announcing his immigration policy after the election, you know, all of these things went strongly against the idea of working with Congress. They were really almost direct challenges to Congress. Likewise, the 6 or 7 veto threats we have out now against anything that would impact Obamacare, anything that would impact Dodd-Frank, anything that would impact climate regulation, anything that would impose sanctions on Iran, the Keystone Pipeline, God knows what else. You know, it creates a really, really narrow spectrum of possibilities. Tax reform had been one of the areas where we looked for progress this year, but in the president's State of the Union, he came out and just seemed to be in a completely different planet,
mm-hmm.
Talking about raising capital gains taxes and ending the step up at death, and
yeah.
Actually curtailing the very popular 529 college savings plans, into which he, by the way, put nearly $250,000 of his own money, proceeds from
Book sales?
Book sales. as a college fund for his daughters.
Nice.
So, in effect, he's denying ordinary Americans what he already gave himself.
It is the world of conflict as we know it within Washington, D.C. All right, Jim Lucier of Capital Alpha Partners at capalpha.com, capalphadc.com. Thanks for coming on the show today. Jim, I always learn so much. I don't know why I don't get you on a lot more often, probably because you don't want to, but thank
you
again for coming on.
Frequently. I'd love to be there.
Okay. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Bush.
All right, Jim. Take care.
Right.
All right, we're going to take a break. You're listening to Engage.
We're making it easier to listen to the Voice America Talk Radio Network live wherever you go on iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android. Download it from the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
Do you know how to tell a great story? In business, the stories you tell play a big role in your success. Whether you're trying to get more clients or influence people as a leader, storytelling will help you do it. Story Powered with Leanne Pico is here to help you activate your storytelling superpower to build a better business and achieve your goals and dreams. Story Powered can be heard live every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 10 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.